Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on StashMyComics.com podcast number 21. We are powered by Geek Energy. With me, as always, is Kelly. Kelly, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. We've missed you the past couple podcasts.
I know. I've been getting ready for college.
College smollage. This is real business right here. This is like real life, not that stuff you'll learn in textbooks. This is what'll train you for the world.
Well, I have to be trained to learn how to work with children in a classroom setting.
It's real easy. Throw crayons at them and give them bananas. Potassium is good for them.
That's so much harder.
Tom couldn't be with us today. Tom is stuck in traffic in the middle of New York City. That really sucks for Tom. I do not envy him at all. The yellow cabs and the horns and all the angry, upset people. Tom, you have fun with that. We'll see you next week, buddy. But we do have a special guest today. I've been promising this for the past couple podcasts. Finally, we are able to get him on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, I have with me Paul O'Connor, who does longboxgraveyard.com and does the Dollar Box on Stash My Comics. Paul, how you doing?
I am just fine, Tim. Thanks for having me on the show.
It is such a pleasure to finally get to talk to you. For those of you that don't know, Paul and I have a history. He's been selling me comic books, namely old X-Men titles. So
this is a history I hope we can continue, Tim.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, Paul, tell us a little bit about Longbox Graveyard. I have plugged you a little bit in the past couple podcasts, but I think you can do a better job than I can.
Well, that's very kind, Tim. Thank you. I do write a website, a weekly blog called longboxgraveyard.com. You can find it at www.longboxgraveyard.com. I publish every Wednesday. Mostly I write about Bronze and Silver Age comics. There's been an emphasis on Marvel books, but that's just an accident. I mean, I really write about anything from that period. And occasionally about newer books as well. I've been doing it about a year, a little longer. I think I just published my 62nd blog on a
Very
weekly
nice.
Basis. Yeah, and it's been a lot of fun. I started the blog just to kind of keep myself honest as I went back into my vast comic book accumulation and tried to make sense of my love of comics and of my life and what they've meant to me down through the decades. So that's what Longbox Graveyard's about. And then growing out of that, Stash My Comics has been kind enough to provide me a forum where I write a column for you guys once a month. It's on the first Wednesday of each month. I write a column called The Dollar Box. And it looks at a single issue comic with a cover price of a dollar or less. So that means we're talking about some pretty old books, unfortunately.
That's right. The current one that's up right now is the dollar or the Power and the Prize. Is that right?
Yeah, it's Silver Surfer number 3, the original run of Silver Surfer. And coming up next month is a look at Marvel 2-in-1 issue number 1. Not a great comic by any stretch, but it's special to me. So I wrote about it for the Dollar Box.
Well, that's very good. We look forward to checking that out. I enjoy the Dollar Box. I enjoy Longbox Graveyard. I've read several articles on your website, and I've enjoyed everything that you've put out for Stash My Comics so far, and I really look forward to what you do. Kelly, what are you going to do now that Teen Wolf is over? What can we look forward to from you next?
Well, there'll be a little bit of break for my reviews. But I'll start reviewing Supernatural when that starts in October.
I gotta catch up on that. Like, my brother bought the first season on DVD, and I watched the first episode, and I really liked it, but never got a chance to watch it after that.
It is the best show ever.
That's what I hear.
So, on season 8.
So much to do and so little time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's see here. I went to Chicago last week, and I went to the Wizard World Chicago Comic Con, and I was privileged enough to get the best autograph in the world, and I don't think anybody can dispute this unless it's like Steve Ditko or Jack Kirby, but they are no longer with us, so they can't dispute. I got Stan Lee's autograph.
Very cool.
It is very cool. It's very awesome. I got it on Infinity Gauntlet number one, along with George Perez autograph too. But it was interesting. The con itself, I'll go into Stan Lee in a second, but the con itself was like so overwhelming. Have either of you ever been to a comic convention before?
Yes.
Paul?
I live in Southern California, so I go to San Diego Comic Con pretty much every year.
Oh my God, I'm so jealous. I could like throw up right now.
I guess it came off a little snarky. I didn't mean it.
I'm just really emotional about it.
That escalated quickly.
it's my local con, you know, so I know I'm blessed to be able to go to that show every year.
Are very blessed.
Well, Chicago was no San Diego, but, I mean, it was still cool on its own because the only other conventions I had been to was the Knoxville Comic and Anime Convention, and that is in this small room at the Holiday Inn that is about the size of my entire living space in my house. So it's very tiny, very small, overpriced books, and a lot of people that don't use deodorant and dress up as really over-exaggerated characters. But anyways, Chicago was so vast and so enormous. Like, Heritage Auctions was there. The group that does Hollywood Treasures, the TV show, the Metropolis Comics, they were there. And a slew of others. Like, I got I was such a fanboy while I was there. I got to show my daughter the coolest things in the history of comic books. Like, we saw two copies of Marvel Comics number one with the Human Torch on the cover, busting out of whatever he's busting out of. I got to see that. I got to show that to her. And my son was standing there with me. He's like, oh, look at that. That comic's 10 cents. Won't you buy that? I said, son, that's not worth 10 cents. I said, that's worth a lot of money. He's like, no, it says 10 cents right on the cover. Won't you go ahead and get it? Oh. I called the guy over to me. I said, sir, could you explain to my son just how much this book is going to sell for? And he's like, well, we're going to sell it in an auction, but this will go for several $100,000. I kid you not. My son's jaw dropped.
Wow.
You could have heard it hit the case.
You've got to learn eventually.
Very true. Very true. But I saw other cool things like Detective Comics number 27, first appearance of Batman. I got to hold in my hands Batman number one. I got to hold in my hands a CGC graded 6.5 Amazing Fantasy number 15 that they were asking $16,000 for. I'd never held a comic that expensive in my hands before. Catwoman, her first appearance, which was, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, but it was Batman number 65.
I wouldn't know. I'll take your word for it.
Okay. Well, then we'll go with that. If I'm wrong, let me know in the comment section, guys. I love to be proven wrong, but not on
Someone will Google it.
But I got to see that, and she got to look at that and hold that, and it was really cool. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was well worth the time, well worth the effort, well worth the drive through downtown Chicago to go to it. But my aunt's driving kind of scared me a little bit, and I'm still recovering from that. But, you know, it is what it is. But like we were talking in the pre-show meeting, Paul, you and I both kind of have some Stan Lee stories. You have a secondhand story that's really interesting, and I've got my 2 minutes of fame with the man. Why don't you tell your story of Stan Lee and tell you mine.
Okay, well, Stan Lee, of course, you know, the master of Marvel Comics. I have a good friend that was editor-in-chief at Malibu Comics throughout their history. And Malibu Comics, of course, brought us the Ultraverse. They also launched Image Comics.
That's right.
I wrote for Malibu for a little while. Malibu concluded their existence by being purchased by Marvel Comics. And there was a dinner, apparently, after that merger, where my friend, Chris Ulm, who was the editor-in-chief at Malibu, got to meet Stan Lee. And Chris, of course, was very excited. I mean, it was a professional meeting for him, but he, like the rest of us, grew up reading Stan's books and idolized the man, and was very introduced himself to Stan. And it was sort of awkward because, you know, it was a merger of two companies, and no one really knew who was the boss. And Stan... which, you know, happened a lot in the 90s. And Stan turned to Chris and said, how does this go? Do I kiss your ass or do you kiss mine?
that just sounds like something he would say.
Yes, and it was, you know, it was instantly endearing, of course, to Chris. You know, I think that, you know, God bless Stan.
Now,
that's all I'll say.
I wrote an article about the rise and fall of Malibu Comics. You guys, anybody that's listening, you can find it on the StashMyComics.com database. Just type in Malibu Comics in the search engine, and you'll find it. I wrote it. It's really informative. I did my research on it. And correct me if I'm wrong, Paul. But did not Marvel purchase Malibu specifically for the coloring studio?
That was a big part of it. The main reason that Malibu purchased, or excuse me, the main reason that Marvel purchased Malibu was to keep them away from DC. Malibu was in a cash spiral. The business had crashed.
Yeah.
Ultraverse was successful, but not successful enough.
For such a short time, and then it just kind of the rug was pulled out from under them. I mean, they were doing so good. They had Ultra Force, they had Hard Case, Prototype, Prime, Sludge, Barry Windsor Smith's Rune, which was a popular comic book. But go on.
I even got to write an issue of Rune that was even published. Malibu Comics, throughout their history, they were always cash flow positive. They always paid their bills, they always paid their creators, but they never made a lot of money. So I think like a lot of companies in that time, they were always, it seemed like they were 60 or 90 days away from going out of business all the time.
See, and that's surprising to me because they were so popular.
Well, what they did is Malibu figured it out down to the last tenth of a penny how to print and how to solicit ideas and how to keep the wheels turning. And they were very good at that, but the business was shrinking in the 90s. You know, after the boom, after the Image boom and after Ultraverse, there just wasn't a lot of growth in the business, and they were casualty of that. So they were business-savvy people. They knew they needed to sell or close shop. So they were culturally close to DC Comics. They had there was a friendship with Paul Levitz, and there was a series of discussions that got increasingly more serious about DC buying the company. We don't know what DC would have done with them, but we can look at the way they handled later acquisitions, you know, and get a sense that DC probably would have been content to have them be a West Coast operation and have some editorial independence. But, you know, it was neither here nor there. What happened was DC was very cautious about the merger. DC is very cautious, at least that's the way they operated. Mm-hmm. So they installed, they had according to my friend Chris Ulm, who was the editor-in-chief there, he said that they just sent a fleet of accountants to the Malibu offices that did their due diligence. And they went through every box of receipts, and they knew exactly where the company was bleeding red ink, and they could tell down to the minute where they were going to go out of business. And
wow.
Chris's suspicion is that DC didn't feel any urgency to close the deal because the longer they waited, the more reasonable the price might be for the acquisition.
Ah, I see.
And they were very close to making a deal, and then a word reached Marvel that Malibu was on the market, and this was a time when when Marvel and DC were fighting neck and neck for market share to be number one. And, you know, the word came down from Marvel buy those guys. Don't let DC buy them, because if you took DC and Marvel's market share and put it together, it would have made Marvel number two. Malibu plus DC would have been a larger share of the market than Marvel. And very rapidly that deal came together, whereas the DC deal had taken several months to come to the point where they were ready to go to paper on it. The Marvel deal came together just in a matter of weeks.
DC was more cautious. Marvel jumped on the opportunity regardless of condition and took what they could to make sure that the other guy couldn't have it.
And see, after they did that, they got the coloring studio and they tried to revive the Ultraverse with the Infinity issues and the crossovers and stuff like that, and then they just kind of fell off. And they designated the Ultraverse as a specific universe in the Marvel continuity. I don't remember which Earth number it is, but they're not using the characters, and that's what bothers me the most.
Well, the thing to understand about the Marvel acquisition is it was defensive, it wasn't strategic, and the people that made it, I believe the management that made that decision turned over almost immediately after the purchase. So what happened was Malibu was just kind of an orphan operation that there was no one in a decision making capacity at Marvel that had a real interest in making it work. So they, they were happy to take the coloring technology and the other things that Malibu had to offer, but culturally, so business wise was a good deal, as they paid a lot more than DC was willing to pay.
Right.
And the stakeholders in the company were well compensated and it was a happy ending for everybody. Nobody went out of business. Nobody went broke. But culturally, it ended up being not as great a fit than if they'd gone forward with DC, where I think, you know, it's entirely possible that Malibu would still exist in some form or another as an imprint or even as a publishing entity inside the DC universe.
Or the characters could have been folded into DC continuity, and we could still see the likes of Prime and Mantra and Rune and Mud and all of that. But we'll leave it there for a second. We've carried on long enough about stuff that makes me mad in comic books, but we're going to take a break for a second, but when we come back, we're going to hit up some news talking about the Dark Knight Returns Part 1, the new DC animated movie. I'm real excited about that. And some shocking news. Well, not so shocking, I guess, but Rob Liefeld calls it quits at DC. We'll be right back in just a second.
Stash my comics.
Stash my comics.
Stash my comics.
Geek Energy.
Okay, so let's hit the first news item. Batman, The Dark Knight Returns, Part 1, the new animated movie from DC. Am I the only one excited about this? Kelly, are you excited about this?
I'm not, like, super excited about it, but, I mean, I think it looks decent.
I can feel my soul crushing right now.
I haven't been excited about one of their movies since Under the Red Hood, so.
Well, if you loved Under the Red Hood, and if they do this right, then The Dark Knight Returns, Part 1, why they're doing it in two parts is beyond me, but this should be equally as good. My personal belief is that this, The Dark Knight Returns, in story form, is Miller's best representation of Batman. Kelly, what are your thoughts on this?
I haven't read any of Miller's Batman, so.
Well, that's not true. You read All-Star Batman and Robin number 9.
Yeah.
We'll get to that later. But, okay, so with this, is this something that you're going to check out? Is it something that you're going to watch?
Yeah, I might check it out if it comes on, like, Netflix or something.
Paul, help me out here. What are your thoughts on The Dark Knight Returns, Part 1?
Well, I don't know if I'm really going to help you out, Tim. I do love Dark Knight, and I like Frank Miller's interpretation of Batman quite a bit. But this, I got to admit, an animated version of Dark Knight, I didn't ask for it. So I don't object to it. I suppose I take a look at it, but it's not eagerly anticipated. I love Batman Brave and the Bold. I've watched that. They brought that back. I love that series.
That's classic, but, though. That's
yeah.
Classic.
But I guess I think I look at, it's interesting to me that there's been a lot of outrage over Watchmen prequels, for instance, in comic book form. But that there doesn't seem to be any outrage that Dark Knight Returns is being turned into an animated
Well, see, they had done that previously with some other of Miller's work, with Batman Year One. And though they, like any movie, they don't stick 100% to the source material. But with that movie, the key points were there, you know. And the one scene where all of Gotham's elite are sitting at that table and then Batman crashes through, you know, the fire sets and all that stuff, and he looks at everybody and he tells them, you know, he's like, I'm watching you, you know, I'm the one that rules the city now, da 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 da, whatever else he says. That was perfect. That was nearly word for word from the scene, or from the comics. Now, with The Dark Knight Returns, that, in my opinion, is a little more gritty, a little more aggressive than Year One is, because with The Dark Knight Returns, Batman's retired, he's old, I think he's in his late 50s now, and he's borderline senile. So I'm just very curious how they're going to take that and put it into animated form. Because with New Frontier, I fell in love with that. That was such a good representation of the work, and it was so classic, and they stuck with the feel of that. And with Under the Red Hood, I mean, if you had never read and Kelly, you can vouch for me on this. If you had never read Hush or anything else having to do with Jason Todd, Under the Red Hood was a great way to be introduced into that because the story was fantastic. Now, Now with The Dark Knight Returns, I'm very curious what's going to happen with that. So let's get some final thoughts real quick. Kelly, go ahead. Final thoughts on Dark Knight Returns Part 1, yes or no?
I'll probably see it, yeah. I'm not, like, super excited like you are, but I'll still see it.
I've got enough excitement for all three of us, I think. Paul, final thoughts on this, Dark Knight Returns, yes or no?
Well, I think in the main that DC has done an excellent job with their animation of their core comic book properties, and I trust they'll do an equivalently bang-up job for this. And, yeah, sure, I'll look forward to it. As a fan of Frank Miller and DC animation, how could I not?
Right, absolutely. Okay, so let's move on to the next piece of news. This one caught my eye. Now, I know some of our listeners are going to be upset because the original piece of news was going to be that Bloodstrike, which is Rob Liefeld property, was going to be turned into a film. Sorry, guys, we're not going to talk about that today. What we are going to talk about, though, is Rob himself is calling it quits at DC Comics. He has been dropped himself from all three titles that he was doing, which were Deathstroke, Savage Hawkman, and Grifter. So let's talk about that for a second. I read the tweets that he put up. I've even got them up right here if we want to go into those. We don't have to, but it's real neat. But anyways, Kelly, what are your thoughts on this? Rob Liefeld dropping from DC Comics.
Well, it seems very sudden to me. And, I mean, I didn't read any of these comic books. I don't have them in my pull list. But I think it's very strange that he'd drop off so suddenly.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting that. I mean, I can remember talks before on Stash My Comics and on other places about how it seemed like they were taking the titles that were suffering and throwing them at Rob and letting him work with it. And it seemed to me that they were kind of going on star power alone to try and boost the sales of those titles. I could be wrong. That's just speculation on my part. But, you know, like one of the tweets here, he says, I believe in what DC is doing, but had to preserve my sanity. Another one, just finished sending my thank yous to DC personnel. Officially got off the DC 52 treadmill this morning. Those were posted today, I believe. But, Paul, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, my thoughts are that Twitter is like a loaded gun, and you know, people consistently point it to their heads. I think, you know, if this were Rob Liefeld circa 1992, Image Comics Rob, 25 years old, I'd look at it and say, you know, he's a kid, he's emotional,
yeah,
that's what happens, right? But this is two decades later, he's 47, he's biting the hand that feeds him, even if he's entirely justified and completely right about it, I don't think Twitter's the right place to air those grievances. I don't see how it can do him or the business any good at all.
Yeah, but isn't he still a kid and still emotional?
And if that's what drives his artistic engine, then maybe he needs to stay that way. Okay, and I totally get it, right? And he's enjoyed tremendous success, and it's not like he's going to miss a meal out of this. I'm sure he can pick up the phone tomorrow and get another job, you know, good for him. But as we were talking before we went on the air, the thing that I find about it is, to me it's kind of sad because when he was 25, Rob had the world at his feet. He was given the keys to the kingdom. He was drawing, you know, the greatest characters in Marvel's catalog. He was making, you know, ungodly amounts of money. And after the Image deal, and I don't know him at all. So just a guy on the street that read his Twitter comments, but to judge by them, it seems like in the 20 years that have followed, he's not grown at all as an artist or as a person. And that's sad to me as someone that's tried to have a career in comics and haven't had the opportunities or the success that Rob's had, nor do I have his talent or his drive.
Right.
But I'd like to think if I'd had that same chance again and again and again, that I could have taken that rage and put it into the work, made the work better, made the business better.
No kidding. I mean, a lot of people complain about Rob Liefeld's lack of ability to draw feet. That's neither here nor there. But I mean, I did say to Jason Martin the other day on the phone that I was looking at my copy of Young Blood number one. Don't ask me why I have it. I just have it. I was looking at it and I said, hey, I said, there's no feet on this. I said, you can't see any feet. It's all covered by hills and all that other stuff. And he said, yeah, if Rob doesn't know how to draw feet. And I was looking on everything that he was doing, like the covers for the Zero issues for Deathstroke and Hawkman and Grifter. Deathstroke had no feet. Hawkman had no feet. Grifter had feet, but they were tiny feet.
They are very tiny.
Yeah. But, you know, some people really enjoy his artwork. Some people don't. I'm in the category of I don't enjoy his artwork because he draws people with really squinty eyes and really tiny heads, really thin waists, and over-exaggerated midsections and chests and all this stuff, and lots of pouches. But, you know, that's what I say. Paul, any other thoughts on that?
Well, just I hope Rob lands on his feet, and whatever his next work is, it gives him joy and professional success. And I hate to see anybody on a treadmill. I totally get how you can be frustrated with the system. I've quit jobs in a rage before, but I've never gone on Twitter and shared my rage with everyone.
Did they have Twitter when you did that, though?
No, I had to send it out. I had to send it out by Pony Express.
There you go. There you go. Kelly, let's get some final thoughts on Rob Liefeld calling it quits at DC Comics.
I mean, I can understand why he did that, but like why he quit. But I agree. I don't think Twitter was the best way to like voice his opinions about it.
One thing I've noticed though is that he's very open and very opinionated about what he has to say, and I guess that my personal opinion would be is that he puts that out in the open so everybody knows, so that way if something were to turn around on him, he could be like, no, take a look, it's right there on Twitter, that's what I said.
I mean, it just seems a bit unprofessional, just the way he went about it for tweeting.
He can't draw feet anyways, doesn't matter. But, all right, so we'll stop there with the news for a second. Sorry we couldn't get to Bloodstrike planned for the big screen. Yawn. But we'll get to that maybe next week. I don't know. We'll see what further developments there are on that. We're going to take a break for a second. Let me collect myself, and we're going to go into the pull list, the two comics that we chose this week. One Tom chose, and he's not even here to get ridiculed about it. But we'll be back in just a second.
Hi, Grandpa. Hey, Grandpa, say, have you ever used StashMyComics.com?
Grumble, grumble.
I know they didn't have the internet when you were born, Grandpa, 7,000 years ago, but now they do. Thank you. And you should go on an internet, Grandpa, to stashmycomics.com and catalog your comic books. Actually, it's completely free to use. Even all the interactive features, such as the member reviews. Well, I thought you'd never asked. They do have a blog with daily reviews and editorial content, as well as a weekly podcast. Yes, I too will go make a donation to this internet comic book webpage in order to keep the service free. It has suddenly occurred to me that my grandfather is dead, therefore you cannot be him. Do you know where I live?
Okay, guys, this is the poll list. These are the two comic books that we chose for you, the reader, to check out and read and be interested in, or maybe even hate. Let's go with Morning Glories number one. Kelly, I have to ask you, why did you choose this?
I just picked something that I had on my computer because I'm not at home. I'm in a dorm, so I just had to pick something.
I was hoping there would be more to it than that.
But no, I really do enjoy the series. I do. But like I didn't have a lot to choose from. So I was like, okay, I'll do this one.
Are you up to current on Morning Glories? I think they're at issue 20 right now.
I'm not. I'm on issue like 10, but I do have it in my pull list.
Okay, so give me a rundown of Morning Glories real quick.
Okay. Well, it's basically like all these kids, they're like really like they have like other sort of talents, like they're good at art or whatever, and they get invited to this special academy where it's like a boarding school. Yeah. And it's like, it's kind of a mystery because it's really weird and like, it's kind of like dystopian almost.
The three girls that are half of the core group of main characters, their roommate and, floor master or whatever it is. She's really super excited.
Yeah.
Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, you're really here. Can't believe it. Oh.
This is like kind of creepy too. Like, if you keep reading, she gets like creepier.
Like a Justin Bieber fan?
No, more like a sociopath.
Okay, so let's go into your thoughts on Morning Glories number one. What did you think about it?
Okay, well, I really, really enjoy the series, so obviously because I'm continuing to read it. But I like the art a lot. It kind of reminds me of Runaways, which is like another one of my favorite series.
That was the synopsis that they kind of gave for this. Nick Spencer, who's the writer, and Joe Eastma, who is the artist. I probably pronounced his last name wrong, so if I did, sorry. But they both said that it was kind of a mix of Runaways and Lost put together.
Yeah, and like I like high school and like ensemble stories, and so that's what kind of attracted me. This, I was like, oh, it's an ensemble cast of characters. Okay. And then like it's like a mystery, and I think that's really interesting, like trying to figure out like what's going on at the school, like what are they doing.
Right on. And the first couple of pages, I mean, really set the tone for the entire series. You know, like you have the two characters that you have the Oriental girl that was really good at chemistry, and she created that thing or whatever that was put on the blackboard to cause a distraction so the other two could try and run and escape. And then as they do that, you don't see what happens to the girl. Her name is Vanessa, but you see what happens to the boy, and that apparition or whatever it is just kind of grabs him. And you have to see it to know what I'm talking about. But, Paul, jump in on this. What are your thoughts on Morning Glories number one? What did you think about it?
Well, I thought it was quite a good story. I've never heard of the book before. The only issue I've read was issue number one, which I read last night, because you guys suggested it for the show. I thought it was, extraordinarily well drawn. I thought it did a good job of introducing its characters. It created an aura of mystery around the Morning Glory Academy. I'm not sure if I'd continue reading the series, but that's that's no reflection on the quality of the series. It's more just a reflection on what the kinds of stories that interest me personally in terms of comic books specifically. Mm-hmm. I think, and I'd have to see how the series developed, but my only criticism of it, and it isn't even really a criticism, it's just a preference, is that the nature of the story is one that could easily be told in other forms. I mean, it really feels to me like a television series, for instance.
It does. Yeah. It does, the way that it plays out.
And I think for most people that would be a strength. For me, I look at it and say, I want to see more things happen here that only comics can do for me, or that comics can do so well for me. So it's a subtle introduction in this first issue, and in the following issues it may become more supernatural, more paranormal. There may be more action, which are all things that I think are better suited to the form. But in this particular issue, it really did feel like a television pilot.
Right on. Now, I did a little bit of research on Morning Glories, the series itself, and it was said, I believe last year, that Nick and Joe were in talks with people to bring this to a different medium, that being television, but they hadn't said any more about it since then. Another thing that they said was that this series was going to have a definite beginning, middle, and end. And I believe he said that it was going to go 100 issues, and then they were going to stop it. And like I said before, they're on issue 20 right now. But with my thoughts, Kelly, in all honesty, I love this book. I really do. I really enjoyed reading this issue. I mean, I caught myself laughing quite a bit, you know, and when parts were serious, I was like, Oh, wow. Oh, I can't believe that just happened. And then I would dive into the book some more. And I had my two-year-old, while I was trying to read this, she would come up to me and say, Daddy, homework? Homework? No, here, let me read this. No, Daddy, homework? Ah, okay. But I love the cover work, the artist that did the cover. That was really good, really rich, and the fact that it's done by Shadowline Productions, which is Jim Valentino's little section of Image. I think that's super cool. Shadowline has put out lots of good stuff, this being one of them, Rebel Blood being another. But what a way to start an issue. I mean, like we talked about before, the first couple of pages, totally not what I was expecting. But one thing I did have was, you know, why is it that in comics everyone knows gymnastics and can kick major ass? Every time. Like, in the beginning, that guy, he's running, and then all of a sudden the school security guards see him, and he turns into this badass black belt, and he's like, crack, kaya, and chops, and then grabs this pipe and flips up on it and crashes through this window and lands like Spider-Man. And I'm like, what? That was like the only thing I had a real problem with. But aside from that, it was fantastic artwork, really great facial expressions. Like you said, Paul, it really reminded me of watching a TV pilot like School of Anubis on Nickelodeon, or even Charmed, and a mix of Buffy in there too. But it was very suspenseful, great mood setting by Spencer. Each of the main characters were very unique. They were very fleshed out. They all came from very different backgrounds. The one girl that had the multitude of boyfriends.
Zoe.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. So let's get final thoughts on this. Kelly, Morning Glories number 1, 1 through 10, what would you give it?
I'll give it a 10. I'll go ahead and give it a 10. I really enjoy the series. It really gets you hooked, and, like, it just gets, like, better and more intense as you keep going. So
right on.
You should definitely read it. Everyone should read it.
Spencer's story, that was worth the time?
Yeah, okay. It's really good.
Okay. Paul, final thoughts on Morning Glories number 1, 1 through 10, what would you give it?
Well, I'm gonna score it incomplete because I think I need to read several issues before it's a taste, but I didn't feel that it was a story that necessarily stood on its own. But on Kelly's recommendation, I'm gonna track down at least the next four or five issues and give it a go.
There you go. I think that everybody should read at least the first six. Just make it through the first arc and see what you think about it. Because me personally, I really think it's a great story. The artwork is fantastic. It's very smooth. It's not jagged and rough and hard to look at. Overall, I would give this a 9.5 out of 10. And the only reason it gets a 9.5 is because of the major ass kickery in the beginning that did not belong. The artwork is very consistent. It's believable. The characters look very human and not over-exaggerated. It's great companionship to the story. The story itself, like I said before, you know, the characters are very unique. It's great mood setting. When it was funny, it was supposed to be funny. When it was suspenseful, it was supposed to be suspenseful. But overall, 9.5 out of 10. That's what I'll give it. Okay, so let's move forward. Let's take a look at Tom's recommendation this week. Tom, it is such a shame that you can't be here. I hope you're listening to this podcast right now, crying in your hands because we can't ridicule you for choosing such a terrible issue.
I wanted him to be here to defend it. I wanted to hear his defense, but he's not here.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom chose All-Star Batman and Robin number 9, written by Frank Miller, artwork by Jim Lee. Paul, let's start with you. What are your thoughts on this issue?
Well, you know, I'll stand in for Tim, and I'll stand up for All-Star Man and Robin. I greatly enjoyed this issue. I enjoyed the series, as short-lived as it was. I know that it's been critically reviled, and I know a lot of people are upset by what Mr. Miller did with the characters in this series, but I originally read it as a collection. I read the first 9 issues when they were republished a couple years ago, and I reread them again last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, you know, I found it really entertaining. I found it funny in a kind of a grim, dark way. I thought it exquisitely well drawn. The plotting's all over the place. The characterization's a little inconsistent, but it certainly is a unique look at these characters. It's going to be an unpopular opinion, but I think it's tremendous. I really enjoyed this book.
It's like a flip-flop of characterization, though. I mean, like, Green Lantern is acting like Bruce Wayne, and Bruce Wayne is acting like the Green Lantern. I mean, it just makes little sense to me. But, okay, so let's dive into that a little bit deeper. Kelly, what did you think about this issue? Paul seems to have liked it. Tell me why you didn't.
I was just very confused. I didn't know what was going on. The characterization was, like, bugging me to no end, because, like, characters are my big thing. Like, if you can't do the characters right, then I just can't, like, read it. Batman did feel like Batman to me, and I was like, what is going on with Robin? What is he doing? I had no idea what was going on.
Okay, now, in defense of the series, it went for 10 issues, and the series itself, anything that fell under the All-Star line, which were only 2 titles, which was All-Star Superman by Grant Morrison, which is really, really good, and I recommend that to anybody, and this, All-Star Batman and Robin, which obviously was done by Frank Miller. It goes for 10 issues, took about 3 years for them to get that far. I couldn't figure out why, except for the fact that maybe Frank Miller wanted to write the Batman that he wanted to write and take as long as he wanted to do it. It falls outside of DC continuity, so that way they didn't have to be restricted by that. But this title, as said by Miller himself, it falls in his Dark Knight continuity, which includes Year 1, Dark Knight Returns, Dark Knight Strikes Again, and the 2 Spawn/Batman crossovers that they did. With that being said, this is what I thought about this series. Batman really, really hates the Green Lantern. I mean, that was pretty evident that was the case. it was a very aggressive Batman. It was borderline out of character for me. I know that it was outside of continuity, so it gave them a chance to maybe try something new. But it didn't seem like Miller was doing that. It seemed like he was going in the opposite direction of trying something new and just turning Batman into this total jerk. Personally, for me, it was not Miller's best. I didn't enjoy it that much. I don't think that Miller likes the Green Lantern very much either. So that's why he had Batman perform a tracheotomy on him in the middle of the comic book. It went from almost laughable at points to being very, very serious very quickly.
Yeah, that was a whiplash.
Yeah. I mean, Paul, and jump in on this here. In the spots where it shows Robin painting the whole hideout yellow, painting everybody yellow, and Green Lantern standing there yelling and complaining and pissing and moaning, and then trying to convince Batman that he knew Robin was Dick Grayson, and then them trying to convince him that he wasn't Dick Grayson. That was kind of funny, but then it wasn't. And then they stole his ring, and then Robin kicked his ass, and then they performed the tracheotomy. So give me some thoughts on that. Let's talk about that scene for a second.
Why you're asking me to defend this? I thought it was a scream. I'll tell you, there's All-Star Batman and Robin is two books. As an issue all by itself is issue number 9. It is a disaster.
Yes.
It is incomprehensible. It makes no sense. The characters behave completely out of character.
Yes.
I mean, it's beautiful to look at. But it's not, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
In the context, in the larger context of both the continuing series, as brief as it was, and in terms of Frank Miller's evolution of the character towards the character that he shows us in Dark Knight Returns, I think it works very well. But I'm also a guy that I'm not terribly attached to continuity, and I'm willing to allow artists to take some chances with the characters. So, yeah, I mean, in this issue, Green Lantern is a total tool. He's a knucklehead.
I almost felt sorry for him.
Yeah, well, Batman totally runs rings around him, right? So does his kid. But in the context of the story, you know, what's happened is that these other superheroes, you know, Batman and Green Lantern, or Green Lantern and Superman and Wonder Woman, who are forming this new Justice League, they're reading stories of Batman and his extreme vigilantism in Gotham, and they've decided, we got to rein this guy in. He's out of control. So, and Batman doesn't want to be part of a team and thinks that these, you know, all superheroes are knuckleheads aside from him. So,
yes.
The conflict is set up in the preceding issues. Lantern is sticking his nose into Batman's business. They have no prior history together in Miller's story. Batman doesn't respect Lantern because he looks at him and says, look, he's a man without fear, but he's also apparently a man without imagination because, man, if I had that ring, I'd make the world a better place.
Yeah, he called him a potato. He had imagination and a potato.
I had just lost it there. I was like, okay.
That was the first page.
I know, and I don't know what's going on.
Helly, oh.
Plus, you know, Frank
like,
Miller.
Why would Batman call someone a potato?
Miller goes right where every comics fan has ever thought. You know, okay, this guy's weakness is to what? The color yellow? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
And he admits that.
And he makes it funny and plausible. And then the other thing is, the Dick Grayson character in this story, this is Dick Grayson's first night out as Robin. And
that's right.
His story as Robin in the Frank Miller story is he's basically suffering from Stockholm syndrome, right? His parents have been murdered. He's been kidnapped by Batman. He's been slapped around, brutalized, brainwashed by Batman. And he's let off the chain tonight.
And he chops Hal Jordan in the throat. And Batman has to perform a tracheotomy on him.
And even Batman's a little appalled by it, right?
It's yeah. Like,
but the amusing thing is, you know, what else could he expect based on the way he's treated this kid, which was to lock him in a cave and tell him, go ahead and eat rats and bats for sustenance, kid. It is twisted. And Batman is a psychopath. I mean, he's crazy in this issue and in this series. And that's what I value about it. That's what I find most entertaining. And, you know, Frank Miller's an iconoclast. He's going to burn this series to the ground and not care about what follows afterwards.
No,
I'm sorry
he's
it was
not.
Never finished. You know, I'm sorry it never finished. I would like to have seen where he took it. I think also, you know, from a comics history point of view, in this series, we're starting to see Frank Miller talk with his crazy old man voice. You know, his bitter old man voice, especially when Batman is growling at people and calling people stupid and telling them to shut up. He's showing the character showing the absence of patience that Mr. Miller seems to have
with
now.
The entire industry.
Yeah, with the industry and with the world. You know, earlier this year, he published a screed on his blog against the Occupy Wall Street movement.
I read that against
government protesters and stuff.
Yes.
And it really was. You know, get off my lawn, you crazy kids. And, you know, borderline unhinged, and it was sad to see, frankly, because, you know, he's a brilliant creator and a vital voice, and I hate to think that he's lost it and he's not going to bring us any more stories.
He is. The stuff that he did with Sin City is fantastic. I mean, all of that, and him being so involved in the film that was made about his work was really good too. 300 was great. And the film itself, though maybe not to the same likeness that the Miller stuff was, I mean, it was still good. And anything else that Miller has touched, his run with Daredevil, I mean, is still critically acclaimed to this day. That redefined the character. And his handiwork on Batman, specifically with The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Strikes Again and Year One. I mean, those took that character away from the 60s camp that everybody associated him with and turned him into this cold, calculating, and sometimes very, very vicious vigilante that took no crap from anybody, including Superman. And that's what I loved so much about Miller's work. But with this, maybe I need to read it from the start to the finish. But with issue 9 as a standalone, like you said, it's a hot mess. It's something that I wouldn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. It's not as best to me, as a standalone issue, the work isn't his best until you get to like the last four pages, when the tone of the issue changes, and Batman or Bruce Wayne realizes what he's done and realizes that he trained Robin this way and he set Robin up for this, and it's not his fault. It's Batman's fault, and he takes him to where his parents are buried, where Grayson's parents are buried, and he just looks at him and he says, go say goodbye. And he sends Grayson out there on his own to do it on his own. That was what saved the issue for me.
Mm-hmm. And that scene works, but I think it doesn't work as well if you don't have the context of their relationship in this series leading up to that moment.
Right.
So it as a standalone moment, it does seem like it's from another story.
That's right.
And I look at the whole Green Lantern portion of All-Star Batman and Robin as being this kind of crazy interlude.
I think Miller just hates Green Lantern, period.
That might be the case.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's always, you go all the way back to Dark Knight, and when he did Dark Knight, Superman appears in just a few panels of one issue of Dark Knight. Mm. But it was the freshest take on Superman that anyone had read in decades.
And it was totally different.
Yeah, and it was wonderful. So I think he's reaching for the same kind of thing with Green Lantern, who's a character that has his own pathologies and has been, you know, screwed up in his own way. And maybe that take didn't work for you, but it was, you have to admit, it was an original take. It was an interesting take. Mm-hmm. You know, for that matter, the way he wrote Wonder Woman two issues earlier, where she's crazier than Batman, right? And I didn't think that was an especially flattering take either, but it was an interesting take. And, you know, we're talking now about a comic that was published 3 years ago, a series that started 7 years ago. We can still discuss it. We still remember it. I mean, what other books from 2005 to 2009 do you remember as vividly as these? So
right.
Sometimes, you know, say what you will about Miller, even his failures are interesting, and that can't be said of many creators in the business. So for that alone, you know, this book will keep a place on my shelf.
So with that, Paul, what would your rating be for this specific issue, 1 through 10?
Oh, now that's dirty pool, Tim, because you know this this one issue by itself, it's probably not fair to rate it higher than a 5, right?
Yeah.
But in the context of the series, All-Star Batman and Robin, and I know, again, this is going against the tide with the way most people feel about it, I'd rate the series maybe an 8 out of 10. I really still enjoy it.
Okay, the issue itself, 5, but the series itself, an 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Kelly, what would you give this issue of All-Star Batman and Robin?
Well, since I jumped in with cold feet and had no idea what was going on, I'd have to give it, like, a 3.
Woo!
like the concept that Paul was discussing was interesting, like with like Batman's out of control vigilante justice and like Dick Grayson having Stockholm syndrome. I thought that was interesting, but like knowing that and just reading this issue and not reading the rest of it,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't match up with the concepts he's talking about to me, like tonally.
Right.
So it just seems very confused.
Okay, so 3 out of 10. For me, I would have to give this a 6 out of 10. And the reason being is personally, as far as this specific issue goes, I don't think that it's Miller's best that I have read. He makes Green Lantern look like a complete fool. But he does touch on his lack of imagination, and I really enjoyed that. I thought that was cool because, I mean, come on. If you've got the one ring that works on willpower alone, are you going to imagine construction equipment and other things like that? No. Batman really touches on that by saying, give me the ring, you know, I'll use it. But there's a reason why Hal Jordan was chosen and Bruce Wayne was not. But anyways, Batman is borderline out of character for me in this particular issue, and the entire issue kind of flips from nearly laughable to very serious very quickly. I had high hopes for the series, but based on this one issue alone, it leaves me questioning. But I am going to give it a chance, and I'm going to go back and start at issue number 1 and read all the way through. So that's what I give it, 6 out of 10. But all right, we're going to take a break for a second, guys. We are going to jump into some trivia after this. And if you've been listening to the podcast for the past couple of months, you'll know that we've been talking about Maximum Overdrive a lot. So we'll dive into that in just a second. But we're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Geek Hotline, how may I help you?
Yeah, hello. I was looking for a solution on how to better track my comic book collection. I've been using memory and pen and paper for a while, but it's not really working out well for me. What can you suggest?
That's a very good question, sir. I'll have to consult my fax machine.
I don't understand.
Excuse me, sir. I'm going to have to ask you to stay quiet while I concentrate in order to better serve you. Since you broke my concentration, I'm going to have to go over to my next machine here.
Why are you using Morse code? I think I better call back another time.
I'm afraid I'm not getting any answer to your question. Here, let me just move over to this next piece of technology that I have.
Is that a foghorn? Am I hearing a foghorn?
Excuse me, sir. I'm sorry, I can't get the answer to your question at this time. But if I can ask you to hold the line, please, I will get that answer for you as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Hello? drive off? Heck with it. I'll just use stashmycomics.com.
Okay, guys. Let's see here. We've got some trivia to go on here. Now, before we get into that, there's a couple of rules, and we need to go over those. Okay, so, first off, you have to be a registered member of Stash My Comics to qualify. If you're not a registered member, it takes but just a second or two to go to the website, register. It's in the upper right-hand corner. You can't miss it. It takes a couple of seconds to get that all down so you can take part in this trivia and win some awesome stuff. Number two, when you enter your answer, you have to put your username on the forums underneath your answer so we can notify you via private message. Number three, anyone that is an administrator of any form on Stash My Comics or works for Stash My Comics in any way, shape, or form does not qualify. So, Kelly, sorry, but you can't... You can't guess this, even though you may know the answer.
Oh, damn.
Number four, the first correct answer wins. Once we have a correct answer, it will be noted on the comment section of that podcast, and the winner will be notified via PM. Jason Martin usually takes care of that, so keep a lookout for his response to your answer. If no winner is found before the airing of the next week's podcast, then the prize is forfeit, boo-hoo, and we move on to the next week. Now, there is the Two Guns Initiative, brought to you by Two Guns 365. If you win on one podcast, you cannot win on the next podcast. You have to wait until the podcast following that to answer again. With that being said... Here's this week's trivia. What we have up for grabs this week is, as always, 1,000 points that can be usable toward any prize giveaways that we have on StashMyComics.com. We'll be having some soon. And there goes Paul driving away.
Sorry about that.
Also, on top of the 1,000 free points, you will receive a free comics digital download. We never tell you what it is because if we told you what it was, then we'd have too many people clamoring all at once, and we can't have that. It's got to be civil. So here's this week's trivia. Name the Marvel Comics character that was used in Maximum Overdrive. If any of you...
I don't know this.
If you've ever seen the movie, you'll know right away. If you haven't seen the movie, then I guess you're going to have to go watch it because it is a fantastic movie, and I stand by my decision. And Jason and Tom are not here to tell me no. Kelly, you're the only one that can, and right now I'm going to put you on mute.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, well, there you go. Then there you go. So...
I actually know this answer. I know this answer, and I have not seen the movie. So it's possible for people to answer this question even if they haven't seen the movie.
Maybe if they've seen, like, promotional images? I don't know.
Yeah, I think if you've seen the movie poster or, you know, you've seen the cover of the VHS tape at the when you're back in the day when you were renting movies, you'll know this character immediately.
Right, there you go. Okay, so with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, go out, be fruitful, find the answer to this trivia question. We'll be back in just a second.
Do you hold up the line at the comic book shop because you're trying to find a gem mint copy of some random X-Men comic book? Well, you just might be an anal retentive nerd, but I have the cure for you. Introducing the Enemanator. It works just like an enema for your mind. Pick it at your local pharmacy or go to StashMyComics.com for anonymous shipping and delivery, only $9.95. StashMyComics.com is not responsible for bodily harm or embarrassment caused by the Enemanator. Batteries sold separately. StashMyComics.com, powered by Geek Energy.
Okay, if only you guys knew what we talk about in between breaks. Alright, so here we go with this week's weekly distraction. Forget the fact that Paul Ryan has been chosen as Mitt Romney's running mate. We won't go into that. Forget the fact that Obama and Romney together think that each other suck, and they're trying to convince us of that. Forget the fact that The Walking Dead, issue number 100 and 101, are going to go back for second and third printings. We're not going to talk about that this week. This week it's a weekly distraction. This is what you will focus on for the rest of the week, and that is going to be Silver Age Comics, why they're so timeless, and why
We love them so much. Paul, this is your area of expertise. So let's dive into that. I mean, this is really what Longbox Graveyard is all about. I mean.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the short answer, Tim, is I think you said it yourself. Silver Age comics are appealing because they are timeless. And even after, you know, these two quibble dicks that are competing for helicopter rides on the White House lawn have faded into the dustbin of history, we will still be reading and enjoying Silver Age books, the stories of both Marvel and DC characters that are have become comfort food for us comics fans, even as they are mined by Hollywood for these gigantic mega-budget stories for mainstream audiences that wouldn't be caught dead reading one of these original stories.
Now, clarify this for me. Where does Silver Age start?
Wow, where does the Silver Age start? Well, I think most comics scholars, and I guess maybe I am one now.
Wouldn't it be the Flash?
Yeah. I think they would point to that issue of Showcase, which brought back the Flash from the modern age. I think that was in 1955, I think, when that was published.
That's right.
And this grew out of, you know, a seasonal downturn in the comic book business and the brain trust at DC saying, well, what have we got in our library that we can reintroduce? And they took superhero stories, which had been popular, of course, in the 40s, and infused them with the new mania for science and science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at the early issues of The Flash and of Green Lantern, and they're very much, you know, science heroes of the Eisenhower or Kennedy administration type. They're forward-looking, they're authoritarian, they're optimistic, and their stories are grounded in a sort of a scientific reality, even though they're utterly ridiculous. They can appeal to science to explain why, due to a necessary impurity in his power ring, Green Lantern's power has no power over the color yellow, or
but,
explain that, of course, as a raft will expand when thrown into the water by Navy rescue pilots, of course, the Flash's costume will expand on contact with air.
Wow.
when it shoots out of his ring, you know. But they were marvelous, marvelously inventive reinventions of classic stories, and then those tales were reinvented again by Marvel Comics and their own Silver Age, which followed 4 or 5 years later.
Yeah, when they came out with the Fantastic Four and X-Men and Spider-Man, and they reintroduced Captain America and brought out the Avengers. I mean, you have Journey into Mystery, which introduced Thor, Tales of Suspense, which introduced Iron Man, and the list goes on and on and on. I mean, what DC did was they set in motion what would be the comic books that we enjoy and that we read today. Because, I mean, if you look at the way that The Flash looks with that Showcase issue, and you look at the way that they reintroduced Green Lantern, I mean, their costumes have not varied much from that. And even with the Marvel Age of comic books, when Marvel hit the scene, Spider-Man, Ditko's Spider-Man, with the exception of the webs under his arms, that really is artist preference. But I mean, that hasn't changed much, you know, over the course of the years. The X-Men, they've changed a lot. But I mean, the core idea that Stan Lee put into that book is still the same after 50 years. You know, I mean, it's for me, I got started in the Copper Age of books, the mid to late 80s, but the farther I got into collecting comics and the farther I got into this industry that I love and enjoy so much, Silver Age was always back there. And then I think when I really dived into Silver Age, it was with Marvel Masterworks, when they reprinted X-Men number 1 and Amazing Spider-Man number 1 and Amazing Fantasy number 15 and all of the big issues that had made them so popular at that time and currently. And that is what drove me into that. I mean, because if you look at it, where DC's characters were more, hands to the hips kind of standing there in their superhero pose, and they're like, now you children, you know, you be good, don't do drugs, and da-da-da-da-da. Off they go to save the day again. You have Spider-Man, Peter Parker. I mean, he's this teenage kid that gets picked on, that's ridiculed, that's generally loathed by everybody in his school. The only people that he thinks love him are his aunt and uncle. And in the middle of this science experiment, that radioactive spider bites him, and he is forever changed. You know, everybody still knows Peter Parker, puny Parker, da da da. But when he's Spider-Man, everybody loves him. Spider-Man was the character that I could relate to, and the same things that he was all about back in the 60s when he was created are still relevant today. And I think that that's what makes characters like that so popular. So let's go into that a little bit. What makes these stories timeless? Why are things like Showcase and Green Arrow, Green Lantern, the old Adventure Comics, the old Action Comics, and the old Superman comics and stuff like that, why are they so popular still? Paul? Go ahead.
Kelly, you want to jump in, Kelly? You have something?
I'm thinking about it. It's such a hard question to answer because, like, everyone kind of started reading comics at different ages. Like, because I'm born in the 90s, mm-hmm. so I read mostly 90s and, like, present-day comics, and I haven't read too many Silver Ages. But, I think the Silver Age is kind of like the quintessential, like, origin stories and like costumes like we discussed a little bit ago that like people like recognize.
Right. The way that I look at it is a lot of Silver Age stuff had to be told in 1 to 2 issues. I think that they were afraid they were going to lose people if they had expanded story arcs like they do now. I mean, now it's kind of traditional for them to run 6 issues, sometimes longer. I mean, Court of Owls in the new Batman ran for 11 issues plus an annual. So, I mean, that's 12 right there. But if you look at it, everything was told in half of an issue or took the entire issue. Because, I mean, with Amazing Fantasy, number 15, half of that issue was dedicated to the origin of Spider-Man. And then the other half was dedicated to another story that I think everybody has forgotten about. So, Paul, what are your thoughts on that? Why do you think that they're so timeless?
Well, I think they're timeless because they were a stroke of genius, frankly. I think, for the comic book point of view, this was our renaissance. We've been living off these stories for 50 years. We'll continue to live off them for the next 50 years. The thing about the Silver Age books, it's interesting, the points you brought up, Tim, because so many of them are artifacts of the business side of comics rather than the creative side of comics. The single-issue stories that you mentioned were a consequence of newsstand distribution in the 1960s, very spotty distribution where there was no guarantee that readers could get a continuing story, a fear primarily that readers would pick up an issue, open to the first page, see it was continued from a story they don't have, and then elect not to buy that issue because they don't want to come in the middle.
Right.
If you go back and read the letters pages from the era, you'll see a debate between fans about whether – all stories should be complete in one issue, or whether they should really swing for the fences and do a 2-issue story.
Marvel broke the mold on that a little bit, and DC too, when they did the drug issues.
Yeah, well, they departed from the code for the drug issues, but also Marvel departed from that in that they had their stories, their characters, cross over with each other.
That's right.
And I think that made their stories, their universe, if you will, feel like a bigger place. Over time, I think continuity has become an encumbrance on comics and maybe has done more harm than good. But in the 60s at Marvel, certainly it was a very fresh idea and made those books feel vital and made them feel current and made them feel, you know, Marvel had the advantage of coming second and they could react to what DC was doing. So in a lot of ways, Stan Lee just kind of turned the table over and said, well, all right, the Justice League, they're like a country club full of guys like your dad. So I'll make the Fantastic Four, which are a bunch of brawling teenagers and one guy that's like your dad.
Yeah.
They can't get along about anything. Or you know, so DC books take place in Gotham City and Star City and Metropolis. Well, heck with that. We'll set our stories right here in New York City. It'll
That's
be a real
right.
place.
In make-believe towns and places.
Yeah, but, you know, their stories were driven by what that day, what that month required. And there's so many books we got to get out, but let's get them out. Whereas today's comic book business, with direct distribution and with everything eventually being republished in trade, you know, a 6 or 12 issue trade run, the artists are encouraged to take their time, decompress their stories,
That's
write
right.
for the trades, which means I think individual issues of comics today are, to me, less satisfying than individual issues of comics from the Silver Age. But in order to read those Silver Age issues, you've got to have an ear for it. It's almost like, you know, it's like reading a foreign language or something. And if you go into them and try to expect them to be like a contemporary book, you know, you're going to be disappointed.
Very much so. I mean, they're not contemporary. I mean, they are campy and they are witty in spots and then very silly in others. And, you know, it's all very quick. And when you look on the pages, I mean, you don't have many full page spreads of artwork. It's all broken up into several different panels, sometimes like 12 or 15 panels on a page.
Yeah.
That I can remember reading Amazing Spider-Man number 36, and it was going into the origin of the Looter, and they summed that up in 3 pages on a multitude of panels, and they got you up to speed real quick. By God, you knew
yeah.
that he was a scientist and that he was turned down for every job he ever asked for, and then he got really mad and really angry about that, and then he found this meteor, and it turned him into this, and it gave him super strength, and da-da-da-da-da, and he was ready to go. 3 pages in. Now we're back to Peter Parker. but Kelly, let's talk about this for a second. Where DC's characters, at least to me, if you look at it, a lot of their characters were the do-gooders, you know, with the exception of Batman. But, I mean, like Superman and Wonder Woman and Green Lantern and The Flash, they're core guys. They were the do-gooders. They could do no wrong. They fought evil. They served justice swiftly but carefully. And they made sure to set an example. But then you go over to Marvel with the Marvel Age, where I think that when they were created, it was more in tune with the times. I mean, because everything had to do – what was the thing that most people were afraid of in the 60s? They were afraid of that bomb getting dropped any second. I mean, and Marvel tapped into that. I mean, if you look at it the Fantastic Four, they were in outer space and they were affected by cosmic radiation. Spider-Man was bitten by a radioactive spider. Bruce Banner was turned into the Hulk by a gamma bomb explosion. You know, the list just goes on and on. Daredevil, he was affected by radioactive waste. So let's talk about that for a second, Kelly. What do you think about that?
I think it's like, it's almost like two different, it's definitely two different sides, because it's like, because you can go comics with one way and you can do very nostalgic and have like someone who can do no wrong and is just a quintessential like hero, and you can be very campy, or then you can like go the other way and it can be like very reflective of the time period, have very like in-depth characterization, and everything is a gray area. So, and that's what I like about comics, because you can read either one.
Right. But do you think that with those two sides, those are still pretty much the same way it is today? I mean, like, DC's characters still kind of feel like that. And it was put to me through Justice League versus the Avengers, the one that George Perez worked on, when I think Captain America – no, it was Superman that said it best. He said, in our universe – were treated like gods, you know, but in their universe, they're hated for the things that they do that are just like us. Paul, talk about that with me for a second.
Wow, that's a big subject. I think one of, and it strikes back to your opening statement about why we still care about the Silver Age and the characters that grew out of that time.
Mm-hmm.
That I think these characters have probably have a single certain imperishable form that can accommodate many different takes, especially Batman, who we talked about earlier in the show. You know, Frank Miller doing his crazy version of Batman, the same character that we've seen as a television character, movie character, different takes in film. They're all recognizably Batman. They all adhere to the same core character ethos, but the interpretation of that character changes from artist to artist, era to era. And that's frankly one of the fascinating things about comics, because these characters have been around so long, they can't help but to have outlived their creators. They are required to have fresh takes, revisionist takes, new artist teams to come in and take these stories over. And when a character is successfully reinvented, it's the most breathtaking, rewarding thing in the comic book.
Like the work that was done on Green Arrow. I mean, for me, like with him standing there being the quintessential Robin Hood, but green, and then when Mike Grell took him over in the 80s and did the Longbow Hunters, I mean, that flipped the character right around. I mean, it took him from this, the pointy shoes and the feather in his hat, and just soaked in this very bright, vibrant green, who was Hal Jordan's buddy, to moving to Seattle and donning more of a natural colors and just going back to his roots and turning into this really focused character. I mean, that was a hit right there. excuse me. Like when DC, going back to what you said before about with Showcase, the start of the Silver Age, taking the old Flash, the Flash that was based more off of the god Mercury, or even Hermes for that matter, and taking that that god awful helmet and getting rid of it and just streamlining him down and giving him that costume, and you see him come running off of the film on the cover itself, and you see, wow, it's the Flash. You're like, whoa.
And even in that first issue, Barry Allen's reading an issue of the Flash with the Golden Age character in it and taking his inspiration from him. That reinvention, and it's hard. You know, sometimes it doesn't work at all. Sometimes creators, try to make these characters their own and fail. If I have any criticism of modern comics, it's that too often modern creators will, you know, they're born on third base and they're telling me they hit a triple. They're able to take these brands, these characters that have 50, 70 years of history. That's an enormous, running start. That'll help you to be successful, but it's also a perilous height to fall from if you fail to reinvent a character correctly.
Like,
I can think of, I don't lay out a failure, but I can tell you three different ways that people succeeded, in my opinion.
Sure.
Three different ways you can reinvent a character. One obvious way is to kind of go inward on the character, re-examine their psychology, tell us that even though you saw him do all these things, he was thinking these things, and it was different all along. So the writer that did that so well was Alan Moore with Swamp Thing, for instance.
Yes.
He took a character that we thought we knew very well and very deliberately, literally turns that character inside out and changes him for all time.
Also, his work with Miracle Man, he did that on him too.
Yeah, and he makes these characters fascinating, and it's very rewarding to comics fans because they get to see he doesn't change anything, but he puts it all in a new light.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that every series is over forever when he's done with it. Every comic Alan Moore wrote, it was like the last comic book ever written. There's just no place to go. So, I mean, you can reinvent, but that's kind of reinventing by clear-cutting. And it works for him because he's so brilliant at it. But others that have followed him and tried to use the same approach don't, you know, they can't pull it off.
I think that's because Moore is certifiably insane.
Yes, I really miss his voice in superhero books. I wish he was, I wish he was still writing them. Then another way you can reinvent, and this is a little more obscure maybe, is the way one of my favorite creators, Jim Starlin, used to reinvent characters, especially at Marvel in the 70s. They'd toss him some book that had no circulation at all, Captain Marvel or Warlock or something, and say, Jim, drop some acid, do what you want. And then he'd turn in these crazy books that had almost nothing to do with the main character.
Is that how Thanos came about?
Yeah, I'm not remotely interested in Captain Marvel, but I love Thanos, and I'm really fascinated by Jack Kirby's New Gods, so I'll reinvent all them, and I'll throw all this stuff at, and it'll fall apart after a half dozen issues or so, but I'm going to give you ideas and concepts that you will continue to mine for the next 50 years.
That's great.
So he goes outward. You know, he reinvents the universe. He says, Marvel isn't really using outer space. I'm going to make that mine.
Oh, he did, though. He took that and ran with it.
And he does. But the one that I think is best and that is hardest to do, so that's another form of reinvention, is to reinvent by embracing, right? By saying, everything that happened before, I'm going to roll it all in, and I'm going to make it better than ever before. And the author that did this for me brilliantly was Ed Brubaker when he took over Captain America around about 2005 or so.
Right on. And right before Civil War took place and before the death of Captain America.
Right. And despite all these editorial crazy crossover stuff like Civil War, mm-hmm. You know, he was able to take that. If you go and you look at the first 25 issues of Captain America, all the goofiest stuff of Captain America is still in there. He's got the Red Skull. He's got the Sleepers. He's got AIM. He's got
Hydra.
I mean, it's all there. You go back and read the Stan and Jack stories in the Silver Age, which are gonzo, crazy Captain America stories. You read those and you think, wow, these are really entertaining, and I'm glad I don't have to make this work in a modern context. Right? And then Brubaker, son of a gun, he makes all that stuff work in a modern context. Just a brilliant job of reinventing the character. It was absolutely breathtaking.
See, I'm in the process of trying to get the Brubaker stuff from that Captain America run. What I'm reading from him now is his take on Winter Soldier, and I have to tell you that is one of my favorite comics in print today. If nobody out there is reading that, I strongly recommend that you pick it up. It hasn't even reached issue 10 yet, and you need to read that because Brubaker takes Bucky, who was Bucky, I mean, and who is now the Winter Soldier, who he used in a storyline in that Captain America run. The storyline, easily enough, was titled The Winter Soldier. I mean, he made that character so popular. And with the things that he's doing with him now, I can't even tell you. I mean, it's so fantastic. I'm so enthralled by how he creates and how he writes and how in reality he writes. That I think is what captures me the most about him. But we are running out of time, so let's go ahead and get some final thoughts on this. Kelly, let's go ahead and start with you. Silver Age comic books. What are your final thoughts on the genre?
I think that they sort of like set the stage for all other comic books that come after it. They're like what people think of when they think of these superheroes, even if they don't read comics. Like,
right.
They're the stories that people like sort of vaguely know if they've just heard about it, and they're the costumes that people will immediately recognize.
These are the stories that those kids had in their back pockets when they were riding on their Huffies. anything else you want to add about Silver Age comics? Why do you think that they're so timeless? I mean, why are people so in love with them and willing to pay just about any price they can to get them?
It's just kind of this feeling of nostalgia you get when you read them.
Brings you back to your childhood, you think?
Yeah, because, I mean, like, I obviously was not born in, like, the Silver Age of comic books. I was not nearly born ever. But I was not even a thought. But, I mean, even when I read them, like, I read, like, the campy, like, 1960s Teen Titans, and I still think they're, like, really great just because they're so fun to read.
There you go. Those are the stories that put a smile on your face when you close the book. Paul, let's get some final thoughts from you. Silver Age comics, what do you think?
Well, I love them, obviously. Even though I'm more a Bronze Age guy myself, I started reading comics in 1974. I think everybody's golden age of comics is 12, right?
Yes.
I think the age when you really get hooked on comics is the version you imprint on. But this would be my advice for anybody that wants to read a Silver Age book today. expect it's going to be a little goofy, expect that parts of it just aren't going to work or age very well. But if you look at it as being not a comic book story, but as being a musical, all the pieces fall into place. Now, this is a crazy idea, but go with it, right? If you go to musical theater, you go, like, my favorite musical is Les Miserables, right?
Okay.
And when Jean Valjean or Fantine, when they come to the center stage and they get hit with a spotlight and everybody else leaves the stage and the music comes up and they start to sing, what are they doing? They're facing the audience and they're revealing their innermost desires, dreams, longings, fears. And it's a showstopper. It's what the whole form is about. We don't think it remotely unusual if the characters are externalizing their every feeling, their every emotion by talking directly to the audience. This happens all the time in Silver Age books. But we kind of, as modern readers, I think we look at it and go, why is Spider-Man swinging around downtown talking out loud all the time? It doesn't make any sense. Why is he telling me things that I already know as a reader? You know, why is he emoting out loud about his Aunt May or his girlfriend or whatever? It's because, like a musical, in a Silver Age book, the emotional subtext is on the outside. It's all on the outside because it's there. Because they were writing to juveniles and they thought they'd miss all the subtleties.
That's right. But, that's right. The looter really put a grind in my gears and getting to Aunt May's house. She's going to be totally upset when I swing my way over to Queens.
It's all on the outside. So if you look at all that stuff, which in the stories is expository and external, and in your ear, you transform it to this is the character's inner monologue. He is telling me as a reader how he feels and what his dreams are. Then I guarantee you that those stories will come alive for you in ways that, frankly, even modern comics do not.
There you go. One quick thing before we go. I've already said this 100,000 times on the podcasts and in articles. Paul, you said everybody's start in comics was at age 12. That's practically true. My first comic book was Uncanny X-Men Annual number 11. But, Kelly, I want to ask you, what was the first book you ever read?
I was actually way younger. I was probably maybe like 4 or 5, and I read the Scooby-Doo comics.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Right on. Okay, that's a good start. What about, like, superhero comics? What was your first there?
Oh, God. Maybe Teen Titans, I think.
Okay.
I have to remember and look at my long box and see. It's been so long. I've been going to the comic book store since, like, I was in the womb. So.
I can honestly say that my mother went into labor with me during Superman.
Wow.
Yeah, and she stayed through the entire movie because she didn't want to miss it, so...
That would be me.
Paul, before we go, tell me, what was the first book you ever read?
Oh, boy. My first comic, it would have been in the summer of 1974, an issue of Captain America. I want to say it was issue maybe 176 or something, but I could be wrong. Now I think that's the right number. It was a Steve Englehart South Asuma issue where, you know, Captain America has given up being Captain America because, you know, Richard Nixon's president and he can't bear to serve the country anymore. Frankly, a crappy comic, right? From a pretty forgettable era, but
is that when he becomes Nomad?
Yeah, like the next issue or something, he becomes Nomad, right? And I'm just a little kid going, where's Captain America? You know, I want to see him throw his shield like he did on the cartoons. But, I stuck with the books, and from that I was ushered into the larger world of the Marvel Universe, and, you know, obviously I'm still smitten today.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. I want to say thank you very much to Kelly for being with us back after a hiatus of a couple of weeks. Hopefully it never happens again. Screw school. You can stay here on the podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll be able to make it now that, like, I don't have my parents trying to drag me around to different places.
Good. Tom, sorry you couldn't make it. You're stuck in traffic probably still.
Poor Tom.
Yeah, right. But we'll see you next week, Tom. Paul, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to hop on this podcast with us and talk comic books, talk shop for about an hour and a half. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was so much fun. You know, I'm happy to do it anytime.
That's great. We're going to have you back again soon. Ladies and gentlemen, feel free to check out longboxgraveyard.com. It is 1978 there all the time. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Maybe we'll move in 1979. We'll be really bold. We'll go forward to you.
There you go. Don't forget to check out Paul's monthly column, The Dollar Box. Really good stuff. We've got a new one coming out soon. We're looking forward to that. Also, some of the other monthly columns we have Crossover Classics, which talks about the Infinity Gauntlet. We were talking about Jim Starlin earlier. He helped create Thanos. That's what the Infinity Gauntlet's all about. Don't forget Kelly. She'll be doing some more TV reviews for us coming up soon. Supernatural is going to get ready to get started, so all you Supernatural fans, we'll have something to talk about, and we'll get to watch Kelly break down some more.
Definitely.
Once again, thanks so much to our producer, Matt, for making the show the way that he makes it. Without him, we wouldn't have this awesome podcast for you. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of here.
StashMyComics.com is the leading free online interactive comic book database. Catalog your comics and track prices, character, and creator appearances. Follow the daily blog reviews, editorials, and a weekly podcast. Connect with other fans through member reviews and discussion forums. Keep abreast of site updates on Twitter at StashMyComics and find us on Facebook. StashMyComics.com, powered by Geek Energy.
Nailed it.